one of the basic concepts that is underpinning civil law, although we don't, well, we do discuss it, but we don't, it won't be something you hear about in the courtroom very often. You may not learn about it from law textbooks. Human dignity. Human dignity. It is the underpinning of many of our laws, criminal and civil laws. Well, from where does human dignity derive? Is it something we simply have made up, a concept that we've made up in order to serve as a foundation for all of the laws and the mores of our society? Or is there an objective basis for human dignity? And how is human dignity recognized and properly recognized in law? We're going to be talking about that here in the fifth of our eight-part series on Christianity and civil law with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. The subject today, human dignity in law. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. If you'd like to join us in this conversation, give us a call, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, with a question or a comment for Dr. John Warwick Montgomery on human dignity in law. We also have an in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is a regular guest. He's Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England, a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, a member of the bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He also serves as Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana. He has authored and edited more than 50 books, including the book upon which this series is based, called Christ Our Advocate. I'll tell you more about that book a little later in our conversation, but first, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hello. Hello again.
We usually think about human dignity today, Dr. Montgomery, in terms of the operating room, the abortion clinic, the nursing home, and perhaps the long-term care, hospice, things like that. But human dignity is a concept in law. What is the basis for this idea that humans have an innate dignity?
Well, if there is no God and there's no revelation from God, there really isn't any basis for human dignity. If, for example, fish got together and decided that fish had a certain value, that wouldn't mean that they actually had such. And if the value of the human being is based on human beings getting together and deciding that they're important, then obviously that has no necessitarian character to the decision at all.
So we're really talking about fundamental principles that underlie law itself.
Certainly. Law doesn't in itself justify human dignity or anything else. You've got to have underlying values that do this, and law then becomes an expression of those values. This is why, for example, in Nazi Germany in the 1930s, a legal system was created which was a functioning system without any question at all, but a system based upon values that did not in any way comprehend the importance of the human being as such. Under the National Socialist legal system, Jews, even though they had the genetic chromosomal makeup of human beings, all the characteristics necessary to define them as human beings biologically, were not considered human at all. They were considered inferior beings and were able to be discriminated against legally and indeed killed without that being regarded as murder.
You have written that avoiding fundamental ethical questions, like the ones we're going to discuss during this hour, is fatal. What do you mean?
I'll give you an example of this. Years ago, I debated the late situation ethicist Joseph Fletcher. Fletcher later became a professor of medical ethics, I believe at the University of Virginia Medical School. And I used to say after he achieved that particular role, I used to say to my students, if you're ill in Virginia and have something very seriously the matter with you, you would be making a big mistake to go to a hospital where the physicians were trained under Fletcher, because Fletcher held that euthanasia was perfectly all right. In other words, if the value system is bad, then the life that you save by not following it may be your own, or turning it around, you may lose your life if you get the wrong value system, or you allow people with the wrong value system to act as your physician or as a person having control over your life.
You also say that no one really ever is able to avoid the ethical dimension. What do you mean by this?
There's no such thing as a value-free approach to the question of human dignity. One will always have some conception of the value of human beings, and whatever that conception is, that will govern the way in which you treat another person or the other person treats you. There is no way that human beings can operate without some conception as to the value of others and of themselves. And so the issue is not avoiding values. The issue is facing the value question and making sure that your values are indeed the right ones.
Someone might say, look, the problem in law today and in general in society today is not that we don't believe human beings have value. The problem is that we are fudging on who human beings are, or who are and aren't human beings. Would you agree, Dr. Montgomery?
Yeah, that's a good point. If let us say, we come to the conclusion that human beings are of infinite worth, and as I say, the only way you can ground that ultimately is by God telling you that human beings are of infinite worth, and his doing this by revealing himself. But let's say we agree with that. Still, we've got to know what we mean by a human. We have to know what a human being actually is. If, for example, we can't distinguish a human being from a tree toad, then obviously we would either be giving human values to the tree toad or, eliminating our own values in favor of the tree toad. So it's going to be necessary to determine who is genuinely a human being.
All right. You have, before we go on to these six very important questions, this is how you have framed the discussion of human dignity in law. We'll be going through each of these questions. You have also written a piece, if I remember correctly, it's sitting down on a shelf someplace, where I believe you compare the concepts of human dignity and human rights between a Western civilization model based largely on a Judeo-Christian foundation and an Oriental model, that is, I think, the religious systems of the Chinese. And you say there are stark differences between the concept of human dignity and human rights depending on which system you operate under.
Yes, that's right. That's in the little book, Giant in Chains, in which I analyze Eastern religious options, especially in relationship to the present-day regime in China, the present-day Marxist regime in China. And I argue in that book that those unfortunate Eastern value systems have so influenced the Chinese mentality that they have not been able to stand against the violations of human rights that have gone on under the communist regime in China. For example, the Tiananmen Square massacre. One example of an Eastern value system is Buddhism. In Buddhism, fundamental principle is that any kind of desire is bad. You should not desire anything. Now, the difficulty with this is, of course, that human beings, by their very nature, are going to desire things. They might desire to give up desire, but they're certainly going to be desiring things. Buddhism doesn't understand human nature properly, and therefore it gets into all sorts of difficulties. For example, there's no ethical system, therefore. You can't even desire the good. The idea is to step away from the world and to step away from yourself and eventually enter nirvana, apparently a state of non-being. Now, if you swallow a value system like that, the end result is going to be, for example, a caste system, the Hindu caste system, in which nothing is done about the outcast, where there are hideous social problems and no one cares, or what the Buddhist kamikaze, the Zen Buddhist kamikaze pilots of the Second World War. This kind of thing doesn't happen accidentally. Messes societally and messes in personal life invariably follow from the wrong kind of value system, and often from an inadequate understanding of who human beings really are and what their motives will necessarily be.
You pose and answer six watershed questions, beginning with, and this addresses the whole issue of human dignity, begins with the question, how important are human beings? Address that question, if you would, Dr. Montgomery.
Well, if we operate in terms of God's revelation in Holy Scripture, human beings are of infinite worth. They are of such worth that God was willing to come down to our globe and take on the person of a human being and indeed die for the human race to expiate the sin of all the generations from Adam right on to the end of time, to make it possible for human beings to enter again into a fellowship with God, and finally to be restored to the original condition before Adam fell. Now, that understanding of man is the foundation for all Western concepts of human dignity. That's why in American founding documents, in the French Declaration of the Rights of Man, in the English Constitution, human beings are considered more important than anything else. And you cannot sacrifice a human being for any lesser end.
You have written to that end, Dr. Montgomery, to assert human rights without a transcendent creator. You said in that case, man simply whistles in the dark as he tries to assert his ultimate worth, like you said fishes before, but you say here a world congress of rabbits voting on the supreme worth of rabbithood.
Yes. Well, that should be quite obvious. I mean, it's clear that, 50 million Frenchmen can be wrong. And as I've often said, in modern times, 50 million Germans have always been wrong. Voting on something, simply the majoritarian opinion of something, doesn't establish anything. In the Middle Ages, everybody thought that the sun went around the earth, but that didn't mean that it did. And so we're obviously never going to be able to establish human dignity by, for example, the United Nations passing a resolution on the subject, or people all getting together and slapping each other on the back, stick in a thumb and pull out a plum and say, what a good boy am I. That doesn't make us of any value. It's essential that the one who created us tell us what our value is. And he didn't just tell us in Holy Scripture. He came into this miserable, messy world that we had corrupted, and he gave his life for us. I mean, there is no greater possible indicator of human worth than that.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. This is part 5 of our 8-part series on Christianity and civil law. Today we're talking about human dignity in law. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. The second question, watershed question that you pose and answer is, how do you know it's human? I guess there are several possible answers here. If you would give us the possible answers, which one you would prefer as an answer to that question, how do you know it's human?
Well, there are really two approaches to this. The very modern avant-garde approach to this is to say that a person becomes human when he functions as a human being, when he acts in a human way. The classic way of defining the human being, however, is according to his biological makeup. A human being is such if he has the genetic chromosomal makeup of a human being. Now, there is a gigantic difference in these two approaches, and their implications are staggering. If, as in the case of the modern secularist, you argue that people are not human unless they function as human beings, then, of course, it's up to you to specify what kind of functions are appropriate. One example of this is an Australian, now in America, I understand, philosopher by the name of Michael Tooley. And he asserted that an entity, I'm quoting, an entity cannot be a person unless it possesses or has previously possessed the capacity for thought. The capacity for thought. Interestingly enough, Tooley is a philosopher, so he says if you can't think, then you are not human. In other words, if you're not like me, you're not human. And on the basis of this, he says that not only is abortion perfectly all right because the fetus isn't thinking, but even infanticide is all right up to the first few weeks after birth because the newborn child isn't thinking either. This functional approach, of course, makes it possible to justify abortion, also euthanasia, the elimination of the unfit, for that matter. What about people at the very end of human life, when they are not capable of functioning as we might like them to function? Does that mean that they have lost their humanity in the course of doing this? This kind of thing is truly ghastly. And who's going to decide on this anyway? Who's going to list the functions, and who's going to rule as to who has these functions sufficiently? I would hate to have government do this, and I would certainly hate to have a committee decide such questions.
You critique the kind of form follows function argument that Tooley puts forth there by saying that human beings do not become such by acting in a human way. Rather, they act in a human way because they are first of all human.
Well, that would be the counter-argument to Tooley. Tooley is saying that it's only by their functioning that they are human. The genetic chromosomal approach to this is, listen, if it has the biological makeup of a human being, you know, if it looks like it's human, it smells like it's human, it tastes like it's human, by George, it's human. It's not a kumquat at all. And the reason why human beings function the way they do normally in a human fashion is because they are first of all human.
The next question, one might be tempted to think, we have put behind us in the United States, having eliminated slavery as a scourge in this nation. The question being, are human beings equal in value? But I suspect you would say, Dr. Montgomery, that this question is still alive and well and being answered in the wrong way, even in post-slavery United States. Are human beings equal in value?
Well, they are certainly equal in inherent value, according to God's revelation, Holy Scripture, as we've already said. But being inherently equal before God is, of course, not the same thing as being equal in social value. There's little doubt about the fact that Einstein was of greater social value, let's say, than a tramp on the street corner. It doesn't mean that one of them had more inherent value before God than the other. Christ died for both of them in exactly the same way. But the social value of human beings differs very, very widely. And I think this is important. It's important because it can help us in some very tricky and difficult ethical situations. For example, let's say that you have an unborn child, a fetus, and inevitably either there should be an abortion or the mother will die. One or the other will necessarily die. Now, the fetus is a human being with the genetic chromosomal pattern of a human being, inherently of of infinite importance before God, just as the mother is. How do you decide as to which life should be saved? Well, the answer to this is surely that the mother's social connections, her social involvements, are immensely greater than the fetus's. The mother has a family, has friends, connections, people rely upon her. She has a significance for existing human lives socially that the fetus does not have. Under those circumstances, contra the Roman Catholic Church, the mother should be saved. But these are of course limiting cases. This doesn't in any way justify abortions for the sake of convenience or utility. We're talking about a situation where it's the life of one human being versus the life of another. That's where it seems to me that the social value factor needs to be brought into the picture, and it seldom is.
So, in other words, that distinction is important in the life versus death scenario.
Exactly.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. He's Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England, a French advocate and barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States, a distinguished professor of apologetics and the history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and he has authored and edited more than 50 books, including Christ, Our Advocate. I'll tell you about that in just a moment. Dr. Montgomery, if we have established the three things, that we can tell what a human being is, we can also assign to that human being infinite worth because of its created origins, and we can also assert that human beings, in terms of their status before God, are equally valuable. Is that all we need to say? We've got about a minute here before we need to go to a break.
It seems to me that on the basis of what we've just said, it behooves each human being to examine his own life. Didn't Socrates say the unexamined life is not worth living? If we do have this infinite value, the question is, what are we doing with it? And what, of course, we should be doing with it is to recognize how far short we fall of the way we ought to be living, how far short of the dignified worth of an infinite being we represent. And therefore, this kind of self-knowledge ought to drive us to the cross so that we get on our knees, thank God for dying for us and for making it possible for our lives to be transformed. Paul says, if any man is in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. All things are become new. That possibility exists, and it seems to me we should be driven to consider that very seriously on an individual basis.
Folks, I told you about the book, Christ, Our Advocate, by our guest, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. You can find out more about this book, Christ, Our Advocate, on the web at CILTPP.com. Now, that's the website for the Canadian Institute for Law, Theology, and Public Policy. The address again, CILTPP.com, or you can call them at area code 780-461-3076, 780-461-3076. 3076. The book is called Christ, Our Advocate. It is the basis for this series that we're doing with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery on Christianity and civil law. 780-461-3076. When we come back, three more questions to consider, beginning with, how important is the individual? We'll be right back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Does prayer bring God to me? Is prayer a pipeline of communication between a believer and God? And is that pipeline a two-way street? You'll find answers to these questions in our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for August, Is God Listening? It's written by Issues, Etc. regular guest Dr. Andrew Steinman. Visit our website, issuesetc.org, for more information or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Is God Listening? Costs $9.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. Does God decide how to answer requests based on how many people are praying? Find out with the book, Is God Listening? By Dr. Andrew Steinman. When you order, tell them, I listen to Issues, etc., and I want the book of the month for August. The title is God Listening? Issuesetc.org or 1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. While some compete for gold, others are in the race for a crown of glory. At the Summer Olympics in Athens, athletes from all over the world are gathered for the games. But many others traveled thousands of miles for the sake of the gospel. Stuart Shepherd is with them.
Outside the gigantic U-shaped Panathinaiko Stadium, people are lining up for the archery competition. On a sidewalk nearby, Ray Coldwell strikes up a conversation with two members of the Australian baseball team.
What would you say is your motivation, first of all, to play baseball and to be professional baseball players?
I guess the motivation to play came from when I was a kid. I saw it on TV, and I always wanted to play the best and be the best against the best.
Here in Athens, Ray and 50 other athletes in action from 21 countries are keeping their eyes on the prize.
It's a passion with me because I feel that God has done so much in my life.
He calls these impromptu conversations divine appointments.
My heart beats for athletes. I see how they have a unique platform in society to reach thousands, hundred thousands, millions, simply by a single testimony on national television.
His chat with the ballplayers comfortably turns from motivation to faith. Ray pulls a DVD from his backpack with testimonies of athletes.
May I give you a CD?
Yeah, by all means.
It's also got the story of the life of Jesus on it.
And Ray scores another crown that will last forever. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepherd at the Olympic Games.
Athletes in Action distributed 2,000 DVDs to players, coaches, and officials in Athens. Their hope is that the contacts made will win some to Christ and encourage Christian athletes to speak out about their faith. AIA is also providing 9 chaplains to the Games who were allowed to counsel and share with players inside the Olympic Village. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Take a class at the St. Louis Art Museum this fall and study drawing from the masters, glassblowing from artists, or celebrate book arts with a book conservator from New York. Take a break for fascination at gallery talks on subjects like animals and African art, 18th century Venetian painting, or a family program on hand-built art. And of course, the 1904 World's Fair and William Blake's Book of Job exhibitions continue at the St. Louis Art Museum. Visit slam.org and improve your perspective this fall.
Does God communicate to us in prayer? Find out with our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for August. It's titled, Is God Listening? By Dr. Andrew Steinman. For more information, check out our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $9.99 plus shipping and handling. Is God Listening? An in-depth study on prayer. 1-800-325-3040.
one 800 730 2727 is our call-in number as we continue with this conversation with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery on human dignity in law, answering some watershed questions about human dignity. We also have an in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Questions and comments for Dr. Montgomery, either 1-800-730-2727 or issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Montgomery, we've established at least 3 of the questions laid here. How important are human beings? How do you know that it's human? Are human beings equal in value? Why the question of the importance of the individual?
Well, because in modern times, there have been efforts to subordinate the individual to the social unit. We may think of socialism in this regard, where the individual has an importance only insofar as he is a member of a larger group. This is a very, very dangerous concept. Utilitarian socialism, as represented by Jeremy Bentham and the Mills, James and John Stuart Mill presented this kind of thing. The idea was that the value of the human being can only be decided socially. One is to emphasize the greatest good of the greatest number. And if that results in an unfortunate situation for the individual, well, so much the worse for the individual.
Actor Christopher Reeve was tragically injured in a horse riding accident, rendered a quadriplegic, and actually would not be surviving nowadays were it not for the advances in modern medicine. He testified recently in front of the U.S. Congress, and he argued that the government's function was to seek the greatest possible good for the greatest number. And he was arguing, of course, for government funding for embryonic stem cell research, which requires the taking of a human life, the embryo, in order to harvest those stem cells. Was he making a utilitarian argument?
Yes, he was. And ironically, whereas it may sound fairly good in a context like that, if you think of it, if you think of that position in a deeper fashion, you quickly discover that this is really a dreadfully dangerous position. One of the best ethical illustrations of this is the blind man illustration. Let's say I'm blind, and you have two eyes. Now, if successful eye transplants could take place, then on the basis of this utilitarian socialist argument, the government could legitimately require people with two eyes to give up one of them for the benefit of totally blind individuals. Well, the eye bank concept, as it were. This, of course, is a horrendous notion. Would you want to have one of your eyes forcibly taken away from you so that it could be transplanted to someone else? Of course not. Philosophers who have criticized the utilitarian argument have said that human dignity, the individual worth of the human being, trumps all utilitarian argumentation. And this is quite right. It's true that in lesser areas we do allow a certain amount of individual suffering for the sake of the society as a whole. Thus, for example, the government, if it deems it necessary or desirable, can certainly expropriate property to put a highway through. But the government must pay the owner of the property the market value of the property. The government can't just take the property away. In instances like that, even if a person doesn't want to have his property taken away, this can be done. Why? Because this doesn't impinge on the inherent dignity of the human being. But if you begin using human lives as fodder for the social good, then you are violating the inherent worth of the individual, which, as we've said in the program already, God has established. You have no business doing this. You can't sacrifice one human being for another against the will of the human being. You can have instances where people voluntarily give up their lives for others, just as our Lord did on the cross. But what we're saying is that the government or the society never has the right to force an individual against his will to give up his life for the sake of someone else. And in the stem cell research thing, that's of course exactly what's going on. The embryo is not asked. The embryo is simply used in order to help other people.
1-800-730-2727 is our call-in number. Kathy is on the line. Kathy, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you for taking my call. You mentioned Christopher Reeve and his arguing for this utilitarian type of view, but doesn't he himself benefit from the opposite viewpoint, or else he would not, because he fell off his horse, it is not for the greater good of society for our to put so much medical cost into someone who who had, quote-unquote, benefit society in a large way. And then how does this connect with fascism and what happened in Germany, and what are the dangers of this type of thinking for our society?
Two good questions, Kathy. Thank you very much. So is Christopher Reeve, in the words of Streetcar Named Desire, depending upon the kindness of strangers against his own ethic?
Well, as a matter of fact, there has been a fair amount of discussion of the Reeve situation. There was a full-length article on Reeve in The New Yorker magazine within the last couple of years, and there the question was raised whether it was right that he has received this tremendous, detailed, horribly expensive medical treatment, whereas hundreds and hundreds of other people who have become quadriplegic as a result of accidents have not had the money or the opportunity to receive such treatment. So that very question has been raised, and ironically, Reeve doesn't seem to see that it's only because of his own wealth that he's been able to arrive at the point medically where he is at the present time. As far as the German situation during Nazism, that's also an important point to look at in connection with all of this, because the Nazis used Jews and minorities in medical experiments, and they justified this by saying that they could improve the lot of the rest of society that way. Now, we look at this with horror. We look at it with horror because the people who were sacrificed were Jews and gypsies and people that clearly couldn't defend themselves. And this and the beneficiaries of this were the Aryan rulers who forced these people into these medical experiments. Fine, but we don't examine what we ourselves are doing. In stem cell research, this is exactly what's going on. Human lives are being eliminated for the sake of other human beings, but the first group are not asked about this at all. They have no opportunity to, because they are the unborn. The British government has just approved stem cell research in the United Kingdom, and articles are now appearing in Europe saying, isn't this wonderful? Now we can advance in this area, whereas grubby old President Bush with his evangelical ideas has refused federal funding for that kind of thing in the United States. Thank God Bush has taken that position, and I hope and I pray that kind of firm moral refusal to go along with a utilitarian ethic will remain in the United States.
So with regard to that issue, have we kind of arrived at the animal farm scenario where we're willing to say, some are willing to say, that the frozen embryo, or in the case of the possible future, the cloned embryo, is a human being, but of course some humans are more equal than others?
Well, the only way that we could justify a stem cell situation would be where the life of an existing human being, Reeve or somebody else, depended specifically on the loss of life of a single stem-celled being. Okay, but of course that isn't the case at all. These situations are situations where if a great deal of stem cells are sacrificed, it may be possible for us in the future to reduce the likelihood of a disease or a medical condition such as quadriplegia. Reeve's life is not on the line in this at all. His comfort is certainly on the line, but not his life, whereas the life of the unborn is very definitely on the line, and it's necessary to harvest many, many, many of these stem cells in order to get anywhere in the research, and there's no assurance that it's going to produce positive results anyway.
Now, the next question you pose is, do individuals have the right of self-determination? What do you mean by self-determination?
The right to do whatever they feel is best for themselves. This is the pro-choice approach, isn't it? The mother has a right to do anything that she wishes with her own body. The aged and the ill have every right to commit suicide if they feel that life has become unbearable, etc., etc., etc. Now, we, of course, love the idea of self-determination, and we love the idea of choice, particularly Americans, because America's the land of opportunity, and you can pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, and you can achieve anything that you want. Children are told that they can become anything that they want to. And, of course, there's a positive aspect to this. We want children to have confidence and try to fulfill their potential in the greatest possible way. But, as someone has said, my freedom, your freedom ends where my nose begins, meaning that you do not have the right to do anything you wish if this is going to cause harm to another human being. And that's exactly the issue in so many of these medical areas. Unwed mother, the pregnant mother, has no business obtaining an abortion for her convenience or for her psychological well-being, because in order to do this, she sacrifices the life of an unborn child. Categorically wrong to sacrifice one life for another against the will of the first.
What about the person who says, no, I'm not talking about abortion so much as I am talking about the right to die, the other end of life, and the question of voluntary or physician-assisted suicide?
Well, it's the same situation there, basically, because God has stated that the value of the human being is such that people are not to take their own lives, nor are they to assist other people in taking their own lives. You don't have an absolute right over your own life. You didn't bring yourself into this world, and you have no business eliminating yourself from it before the time actually comes. It was Sir William Blackstone, the writer of the first textbook of the English common law, who said that the reason why suicide should be criminalized is there are two reasons, really. One is that the person removes himself from assisting his sovereign, and therefore the state is diminished, the government is diminished, the country is diminished by the fact that you've dropped out. But he said more than that, more important, you are entering the presence of God without an appointment.
So the person, I'm trying to bring this together, the person who says, my right or my alleged right to self-determination gives me absolute sovereignty over myself in terms of life and death, whether I want to terminate a pregnancy, an abortion, or whether I want to take myself out of the picture through suicide. You say that is also, that's a coram dea and a coro omnibus question. It's before God and before men that we are guilty there.
Sure. Sure we are. The fact of the matter is that nobody lives in isolation. This notion of self-determination and choice and absolute choice, this notion is predicated really on the idea that an individual operates without any impact on anybody else. Well, as a matter of fact, you know, John Donne, the great Christian poet and preacher, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. We're all interconnected in society, and more important even than that, we have a responsibility before God. We can't act in isolation as if there were no God or there were no society of people around us. I knew the late Lord Hailsham of St. Marylebone quite well, and he, in his first autobiography, wrote about his brother's suicide, and he said, if my brother had any understanding of the impact of that suicide on the lives of every member of the family from that point on, right on to the end of their lives, he surely never would have done this. The suicide doesn't take into account the fact that his own personal misery, whatever it may be, is small in relation to the misery that he can cause to other people by doing this.
We're talking about human dignity and law with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. He is author and editor of more than 50 books, including Christ Our Advocate. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. So, Dr. Montgomery, in order for me to believe that I do not have absolute sovereignty over my own life, I have to believe that there is an ethical standard bigger than myself, something that I do not determine, but, to put it crassly, determines me. Are ethical standards, such ethical standards, do they exist and are they absolute?
Today, many people would say that there are no such standards, that all is relative. Of course, the trouble with that statement is that you have to determine whether the statement all is relative is absolute or relative, right? If that statement is absolute, then of course not all statements are relative, and if it isn't absolute, then it doubtless can be wrong. The fact is, you must always start from some firm point. Einstein's theory of evolution, involving E equals mc squared, the famous formula, even that formula, the theory of relativity, has a constant. The constant is the velocity of light. That's what's squared in the formula. Now, that wouldn't have to be taken as the constant, but you've got to have some point of departure, point de départ. You've got to. Therefore, everybody acts as if certain things are absolute in his own or her own value system. The real issue is, can we find any standards that are genuinely absolute, that aren't absolute just because we treat them that way, but because, in fact, that's what they are? And here we go in full circle right back to what we were saying at the beginning of the program, that without a God, without an absolute God, and without a revelation from him which is clear and absolute, you're not going to find any such standards. But if there is a God, and that God is infinite and absolute, and if that God reveals himself in a scripture which is reliable, which is trustworthy, entirely trustworthy, then you've got standards. The standards are there in that revelation.
As a final question, it comes to mind that this is apropos of what the news is of late. We have revisited the whole Abu Ghraib scenario, the torture of and the mistreatment of prisoners in the Iraqi prison. A new report has just come out. Now, not with reference to that report, Dr. Montgomery, but with reference to the goings-on at Abu Ghraib that are under inquiry. How does the entire complex of questions we've been asking and answering in this hour bear upon a situation like that, the mistreatment of prisoners, whatever they may be, in prison?
If this were a matter of, let us say, legally punishing those who had been tried for crimes, and the punishment was also a matter of law, then we wouldn't have problems with this. But the difficulty with the treatment of these prisoners of war or terrorists or whoever they were in Iraq, the trouble with this was that this was done extra legally, and what they were subjected to was an affront to human dignity. I mean, the fact that they were forced naked to crawl all over each other and possibly have sex with each other, and the fact that they were treated like animals, this is utterly disgusting. It is against human dignity. There is no justification for it whatsoever. And in my opinion, if there is sufficient evidence, as there apparently is through those photographs, that American military personnel did this kind of thing, they should be tried, of course, by a military court. They should be cashiered, and they should be jailed. They should throw the key away. I mean, the harm that that did to the proper cause of the Iraqi war is incalculable. It's incalculable. And anyone who has an understanding of absolute moral standards is sickened by seeing this kind of thing. Those people did more harm to America than many terrorists have been able to do. My goodness, I would yank their American citizenship, for heaven's sake.
Dr. Montgomery, before we let you go, you're the director of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, held each summer in France. What is this academy, and how many openings do you have for next summer?
Well, this is the only Institute of Advanced Studies in Christian Apologetics. It's an intensive two-week session. It takes place in the middle 2 weeks of July each year in the French Rhineland, a wonderful area, and there are social activities that are interlocked with this through the entire 2 weeks. It's a wonderful experience, and four of the top apologists in the world, defenders of the faith, instruct the 20 students who are allowed to come to this for a period of 2 weeks in the nine fundamental areas of apologetics. There are nine mini courses of 4 hours each. It's an amazing opportunity. Next summer, Craig Hazen, who is the editor of the most distinguished Christian philosophical journal, Philosophia Christi, professor at Biola University, will be there. Oliver Wilder Smith, the son of the great A.E. Wilder Smith, he's a medical doctor, and he deals with areas of scientific and medical apologetics. Craig Parton, who is on issues of continually, and your humble servant, all of us will be providing that instruction. Now, all of that is the good news. The bad news is that there are already 17 people signed up for the program, meaning that there are three places left. We may be able to expand this just a bit for next summer, but it won't be expanded by more than five people. So if any listeners are interested in doing this, they've got to get in touch with us just as quickly as possible.
Folks, if you'd like a free information brochure on Dr. John Warwick Montgomery's International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, or if you'd like to make a tax-deductible gift to help us defend life from beginning to end, call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, or write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. We'll send you a free information brochure on the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, thank you for being our guest.
It's always a pleasure.
Dr. Montgomery is Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England, a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, author of that book, Christ Our Advocate. Next week with him, part six of our eight-part series on Christianity and Civil Law.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.